You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
People keep asking, are we back? Yeah, I guess we're back.
Back to talk about cigars, movies, TV shows, and any other nerdy topics here on the Cigar Nerds Podcast. Check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com and ESONetwork.com. And we have a YouTube channel at Cigar Nerd Podcast, where we do cigar reviews, live versions of the show, and any other dumb thing we think to record.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And I'm not sure how to introduce this week's episode, because it's different from any other film that we've done so far in the near 7 years Monster Attack has been doing podcasts. It is a very, very special film, and I want to say right off the bat that parents, for young children, this is a film that is not for young kids, not at all. It is one of the most graphic, horrifying movies I think I've ever seen in my entire life, and that's saying quite a bit. The film is called Threads. It's a documentary that came out of the BBC, and it deals probably with one of the worst monsters that we have ever dealt with it, ever on Monster Attack, and that's mankind himself. Because we're the ones who are the monsters in this movie, because of the way that we use nuclear weapons and pretty much end mankind as we know it. Yes, it's an anti-nuclear film. And it seemed like, you know, for the second season of Monster Attack, and then this past season, we concentrated a whole lot on films that came out in the mid to late 50s. Films that were influenced greatly by fears of nuclear war, nuclear capabilities. And I just recently, these last couple of weeks, did a film about astronauts coming back to Earth hundreds of years later and discovering that Earth had destroyed itself in a nuclear war. So I thought it was about time that we brought this film out, because we're talking about, when we talk about old monster movies or old horror films, we talk about films that impacted us a lot growing up, films that scared us, and this one certainly did both to me. Now, I wasn't a kid when I saw it. I first saw it in 1985. I had just turned 30 years old a few months before that. And this film disturbed me to no end. Now, those of you that were around in the 80s will remember, and I'm sure you're thinking of this right now, that we did a film like this in the United States. It wasn't a documentary. And of course, this is more of a docudrama, what we're talking about today. I want to correct myself slightly on that. It's not a pure documentary, but it might as well be. But there's a two-part event here in the United States. I believe it was on ABC TV, if I'm not mistaken. And it was called The Day After. And it had a plethora of television and film stars in it. And it dealt with what happened, what would happen if the United States and Russia got into an exchange and exchanged all of their nukes and what the aftermath would be like. Carl Sagan was a little critical of the film, saying that it didn't show it bad enough. And I have to agree with him. I was a little disappointed with the movie. Yeah, you know, it was a huge, huge buildup. Could not wait to see it. I remember it was, I think it was Sunday night and a Monday night, if I'm not mistaken. I was watching it on a little 19-inch black and white TV. And it was a powerful film, but I knew that they really sort of dumbed it down. There was, I think, a fear on the part of the networks as to how much they could really show. They showed a lot more than I had expected they would. I'm hoping, I'm going to have a chance to meet Nicholas Meyer in a few months, and I'm hoping I'll get the opportunity to ask him about the movie and find out some more about it. So we had The Day After, and then I remember watching Siskel and Ebert. And by the way, in between these two viewings, I moved to Georgia. This is when I relocated to Georgia. So I had just moved to Georgia about a month before, watching Siskel and Ebert. I loved the show. And in all honesty, I can't remember if it was still called At the Movies or if it was now Siskel and Ebert. And Gene Siskel brought this up, and he and Ebert had a brief conversation about it, because they normally didn't review made-for-TV films, especially ones that were shown in Great Britain. They were trying to get a viewing here in the United States. And they started talking about this because they just found out that Ted Turner of WTBS had made arrangements to show the movie Threads on his station, on his superstation. I didn't know anything about the film until I had seen the Siskel and Ebert show. I had not heard of it. And both Siskel and Ebert were quite graphic in saying that it was one of the most horrifying films they'd ever seen. Siskel gave it 4 stars, which was very rare for him. So I definitely put that on my radar. Fortunately, I was living in Georgia, so I could, my house had an over-the-air antenna, but I could get WTBS. I was really looking forward to seeing this one because of the hype it got. And I got to say, folks, I was not disappointed. It's an odd thing, and it's a little hard to explain, maybe for our younger crowd here, those that were born after all of this happened. When Ronald Reagan was announced, as the new president in 1980, and he won the election in 1980 over Jimmy Carter, they called him Ronnie Reagan. He spoke very, very tough about how he was going to, deal with the Russians, and get us, back on top in foreign affairs. It sounds similar to some of the talk we've been hearing in the last few years. And even though the Cold War had sort of mellowed out, there'd been several peace treaties about launching nukes. There was a fear all of a sudden that Ronald might start a war the way he was talking. Well, fortunately for us, the Cold War came to an end during his administration. The Berlin Wall came down and a lot of tensions eased off. And we got a little spoiled by that for the next several years, that things were, we'd have these little flare-ups here and then with other countries. But for the most part, the fear that we had growing up, and I've said this so many times, and again, I know I'm flogging a dead horse here, but I'll say it one more time. As kids growing up, from the time I was in first grade and the Cuban Missile Crisis and events like that, we as kids grew up expecting that someone would do it, someone would push the button, and then the other side would have to push the button, and then it would all be over for the entire planet. And that was supposed to be the movie that The Day After was going to be, but it didn't quite do that. This one gets pretty close. Like I said, this is not a film that you're going to get the family together and watch. But I believe it is a film that every living human being needs to watch sometime in their lifetime. As long as we have this sword of Damocles hanging over us, with nuclear weapons, and now all of a sudden they're coming back into the forefront. And again, folks, I try to avoid politics on this podcast as much as I can. It's going to creep in a little bit on this one because it's something we're dealing with right now with what's going on over in the Ukraine and rumors that Putin is bringing in tactical nuclear weapons. For those of us who know that there's no such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon. You got a nuclear weapon or you got a conventional weapon, but when you get into nukes, no matter what size, it's all over. It's game over. That's the one thing they got right in The Day After, when the soldiers who were guarding the missile silo in Montana were arguing about, well, what do we do now? And the one guy argued, he said, hey, the war's over. We did our job. It's done. We might as well just go home, because that's how it is in a push-button war. Once both sides have pressed their buttons, that's it. It's done. And Threads shows it in a very graphic way. I'm not going to be comparing Threads to The Day After this whole podcast, but the one comparison I will make right now, just to give you the parents out there that have not seen this movie, and there's a lot of people in the United States that haven't seen it. It had that one showing on WTBS. It was released on VHS. I had a copy of that in my original collection. It has been released on DVD, and I believe there are actually plans of releasing it on Blu-ray, if I'm not mistaken. But the remastered DVD is incredible, and it is terrifying. Because what makes this movie so terrifying is that it could happen. Now, back in the 80s when I saw it, it was very real. And then when I saw it again several years later when I got my VHS copy, which was in the 90s, watched it again, it was like, wow, yeah, that was a heck of a film. But by then, things had cooled off a little bit, so it wasn't quite so bad. It's still frightening to think that we were capable of doing something like that. But then sitting here in my apartment the other day, and I think it was right after I had finished the show Beyond the Time Barrier, and I got thinking about it, and then I saw the news, and I'd been sort of avoiding the news on and off for the last few weeks. I mean, I'm watching it, but I'm not being a news junkie like I used to be. They were talking about Ukraine, and it was still heating up. It was still getting pretty crazy. And I got thinking, you know, I don't know what they're going to do over there. And what would happen if the Russians launched a tactical nuclear weapon against Ukraine? Just if. What would we do? What would others do, other countries, especially those that have nuclear capabilities? You know, would that set it off? Because once one side gives in, that's it. It's over. It's all over. And that got me thinking about Threads. And I was like, yeah, I got to do a show on that because this is a film that needs to be seen. And it needs to be talked about very, very honestly. And in a moment here, we're going to talk about the people who made this possible, who put this film together. These are going to be people you do not recognize. The director and the writer, you may recognize their names. The director especially, because he made some films that are fairly well known by Americans. Mick Jackson is the director. This is going to be the film he'll always be remembered for because of the impact it had on people. And I think we'll have again, because I think there's going to be a resurgence of this film with what's been going on. Because people are scared again. We just don't know what's going to happen. And there's still a lot of nuclear missiles out there. Mick directed in 1997. He directed Volcano. That was one of the last films that he directed. He did The Bodyguard. You might remember that one. Temple Grandin, excellent TV movie. And L.A. Story, which I think is a very underrated film, but a very good one, from 1991. When he directed this film, it was relatively early in his career, but it's certainly one that got the attention of a lot of people. I'll tell you what. 36 altogether he's directed, but none as powerful as Threads. And at the time that the BBC decided to produce this film, or at the time they wanted to produce a film showing a nuclear holocaust, and so they were hunting around for a director and a writer and stuff, and they hired Mick Jackson first. And a lot of people, including Mick Jackson, thought it was pretty incredible that this was happening because of a documentary that had been made in 1966 in Great Britain called The War Game. It wasn't shown on TV because the TV folks said we can't show this. It is going to panic everybody. And of course, in 1966, you are right at the height of Cold War fears. And they're probably right. It probably would have. It had a limited run in movie theaters. I have been trying to get a hold of a copy of this film for about a year now. It is I can find clips of it, little snippets here and there, but I have not been able to find the full film. Still looking for it. And I'll find it. It's out there. But the government basically said to the TV people, no, you are not going to put this on TV. And cause a mass panic among everyone in the United Kingdom. So in the mid-1980s, 1984 or so, when the subject again comes up and the BBC says, yeah, we're going to do a made-for-TV film about what would happen if they launched all the nukes, everybody was pretty surprised. And this one did get a showing. And then it took a few months to get over here to the United States. And Ted Turner was so insistent on getting this shown to American audiences. He was trying to get local stations to kick in. He was trying to get some commercial backing for it. so that he would be able to get it on the major networks, and he wasn't able to do it. So Ted, and those of you who know Ted Turner, I had the opportunity to meet him many years ago. It was right after he launched CNN2, Headline News. And I was working for a TV station back then. Very impressed with the guy. And he was headstrong. And I was like, okay, I'll just pay for it myself. And he went out of pocket and totally financed Threads being shown on American television on the 13th of January of 1985. Happy New Year. Around the same time, it was shown on in Canada and also in Australia. And then from the response of people seeing it on WTBS, then PBS decided, hey, we're going to show it too. And it did later appear, later that year, that showed on a number of PBS stations around the country. And Siskel and Ebert may have had a little help with that one as well, since their show was on PBS. So let's talk about Threads. And again, folks, I can't emphasize enough what makes this film so terrifying is, like, you forget in the middle of this film when you start seeing the war. From that part of the film on, that starts in about 20 minutes in, you almost forget you're seeing a movie. You're feeling what these people are feeling. You're absolutely shocked. You know, it's almost like all of a sudden, and I don't know how Mick Jackson did this, and I think the writing may have had something to do with it, and I want to give kudos to the writer, Barry Hines. Barry was responsible for 8 screenplays in his career. We lost Barry in 2016. He was basically known for doing continuity on movies, a very, very important job. But wrote a number of things. So Threads was one of the last scripts that he wrote. Most of what he wrote was seen in Great Britain. I'd not seen any of his films. I'd heard about the one he did in 1969 called Kes. It's about a boy and his pet bird, and an American company was trying to get the rights to it so they could make a version of it, and he wouldn't let them do it. But I haven't seen the movie. Looks and Smiles was his other film, and Screen One. But Mick Jackson knew him well, and he said, that's the guy I want, because he knew that Barry Hines was very dedicated to the topic and the subject of scaling down nukes, of doing away with nuclear weapons, which we've been trying to do for decades. But unfortunately, and I should tell you right now, I've got my email up and someone just emailed me. I had asked someone earlier in the week about a Blu-ray of Threads, and yes, it is available on Blu-rays. Okay. You're not listening to this live. This is a recording, folks. But it was released 5 years ago by Severin Films, so you can find it on Blu-ray. And I got to tell you, folks, I mean, I saw it in high def just yesterday again. I've seen it twice this week now, getting ready for the podcast. Be prepared. I will say that. That's why, parents, you know, for the love of God, if you've got very small children, watch this movie before you let them watch it. Because I really don't think a small child could handle this film. The scenes in here are just so disturbing. Don't let them watch it. Okay. So now we got this film. It goes into production. It centers around 3 different areas, 3 different story plot lines. You've got a young couple, and we're going to talk about the gal that plays the female part of that couple in just a second here. Her name is Karen Mager. And she does a job that the word incredible doesn't describe enough. We'll get to her in just a second. This young couple, they just found out they're going to have a child. And, this is all before, nobody's paying much attention to the news. It's very similar to the way The Day After was presented. You knew there were some problems going on in the Middle East. It's not just like The Day After. It was, you know, their problems centered, you know, with some flare-ups in the Middle East that involved the U.S. and Russia, Iran, and other countries there, and things heating up, escalating. But all they're concerned with is, you know, she finds out. She plays a gal by Karen Mager plays a gal by the name of Ruth Beckett. She's dating a guy named Jimmy Kemp, played by Reese Dinsdale. Again, I don't expect you to know any of these names. I didn't know any of the actors in the film when I saw it every time I saw it. These guys are, you know, relatively successful in Great Britain. They haven't done much in the United States except for this film. And they decide they're going to get married. They got an apartment. They're fixing it up when all of this stuff is heating up. The story extends out to their family. Jimmy's family, his mother and father. Father's a little worried about the fact that they're in the middle of a recession. Not the time to be starting a family, but he respects the fact that his son is doing the right thing. And her family, you know, again, they're very, very conservative, and they take care of his mother, her father's mother, who is probably is a woman who is in her late 80s, maybe, or mid 80s, as she's portrayed in this. Then the other storyline we follow is the one that intrigues me a great deal, because it deals with the government. This takes place in the town of Sheffield, England. It's an industrial town. And again, they're going through the recession, so there's a high unemployment rate at the time. But they are located near an Air Force base, near enough to be in harm's way. And we're looking at the preparation that the government has made in Great Britain for the eventuality that maybe everybody is going to launch nukes against one another. And they're quite prepared. It's part of their civil defense. Now, it's interesting, when Mick Jackson cast the film, he cast it with people that nobody would know. He wanted actors that the audiences would relate to completely. So when you look at Karen Mager or Rhys Dinsdale, you know, you don't remember them for any other films. Now, Karen Mager later on would be a big part of a number of BBC productions. So she got quite well known. But at the time that she did this, nobody knew who she was. And when she auditioned for the role of Ruth, who was a major, major character in this film, she had been an active member of the organization that wanted to demilitarize nukes. So this was a subject that was near and dear to her heart, and it meant a great deal to her. And you could tell there's a real love there, the way she does this. Because this was not an easy film for a lot of the cast to make. Not at all. But the thing that really intrigued me about the other aspect of this, watching it from the point of view of the government, they had everything all planned out. And they've already got, you know, their heads up on this thing. Nobody's expecting it to come to nukes. But they want to be prepared anyway. So they're treating it as if it's right around the corner, which it was. Getting the food stores in place, and you know, they've got their shelter in a place where they can operate the government from underground. Feeling pretty good about the preparations they have. They've got all of these people that are handpicked that they will take with them into the bunker. And that was the part, I think, that intrigued me the most. We didn't see that in A Day After. You know, we saw it from the point of view of a hospital and a farmer and Steve Guttenberg's character, you know, the people at the University of Kansas, the students and the faculty there. But in this one, they concentrate, half this movie is centering around what the government did to get ready for this and what was involved with it, because a lot of these people had to leave their families when they went to like a yellow alert, when things started really escalating all of a sudden. And this is done really well by Mick Jackson. He brings it in with like news coverage. It added a real sense of reality to it. And a small nuclear bomb does get exploded. And the United States returns with another one. I mean, a little one. Not even as the size of the one that was dropped on Hiroshima. But still, a nuke. The United States takes out an air base that the Russians had set up in Iran. They take out a large aircraft carrier. And that's when things start getting a little dicey. What are we going to do? And of course, the government is already moving on it. And so they're in their bunkers. By the time that the red alert sirens go off, and that is frightening, folks. Absolutely frightening. You've got Jimmy who works, he cuts lumber. He and his buddy, they have a lumber business, a little lumber business. They deliver lumber around, and people are on edge. You can tell they're on edge, and they're, you know, they deliver it from the back of a flatbed truck or whatever to the orders that they take. And all of a sudden, all the power goes out. We're talking about the EMP effect. The red alert has just gone off, and seconds later, all of the power grid is just, you know, short-circuiting out. And then the air raid sirens go off, and of course, Jimmy realizes what that means. His friend, who was sort of a, you know, devil-may-care type guy, like some people would do, just deny it. It'll just go away. And he dives under the truck with his friend. He pulls him under just as we see the light from the explosion. And, of course, it blinds some of the people right there that look right at it, because your first instinct is to see what it is. And then you get the aftershock or whatever, you know, the blast. And this isn't something where it looks like someone's taken an X-ray of a person and then a skeleton. No. This is gruesome. This is absolutely gruesome, because Sheffield is just far enough away so that the folks there wouldn't be vaporized. You know, and as a kid, I always said growing up, if this is going to happen, I want to be right there on ground zero. I want to look at it coming in. Because, you know, I want to go in an instant. I don't want to drag out. But unfortunately, Sheffield was about, I believe they said, 15 miles away from where this Air Force base is. It's a NATO military target. 17 miles. There's my notes. 17 miles from Sheffield. So they're in that, you know, if you've seen some of the studies that are done about nuclear war, you know, the rings coming out from ground zero. You know, within the inner ring, everybody is vaporized. Everything is vaporized. Then the next ring out, you've got people pretty much are dying from radiation poisoning, badly burned, because if you burn so much of your body, you're not going to survive. I mean, it's the biggest organ you have. You know, and all of the horrors that would go with being alive for a few days after being exposed to that kind of explosion and the pain that you would be in. And folks, the Red shows it all. Their attack scenes are unlike any I have ever seen in any other movie dealing with a nuclear holocaust. Even today, we are almost 40 years removed from when this film was made, and I've never seen anything as graphic and as gruesome as what they show. Now, on the day after, they showed a lot of stock footage from the Department of Defense of the nuclear tests they did in the desert. That was the biggest disappointment to me in showing that. I mean, they did show a couple of created scenes or whatever, but nothing like this. Jimmy's family, his father, has taken a whole bunch of mattresses and stuff. He's piled that up. He's piled up some other things. When they went to yellow alert, they had about a day's warning before this was going to happen, before the red alert, before the missiles actually came in, to try to make a barricade or whatever, because they didn't have a basement. Now, Ruth's parents had a basement, so they were all heading down into the basement when the explosion finally went off. They were at least away from the impact, but you know. And of course, they're trying to help his mother down the stairs, and all of that. And again, everybody's in shock, you know, because here you are. All of a sudden, it's real. It's real. The closest thing I can equate it to, as many of you know, I survived an EF4 tornado, and I think the seconds before the tornado hit the house, and then immediately following it, I think my state of mind, which I have vague memories of right now, but from what I recall, was probably very similar to that, where it was like, oh my God, this really happened. There's a side of your mind that's not sure if it's real or not. You've always imagined like, well, I know what it would probably be like. But then when it happens, it's a whole different ballgame. So that's what you're dealing with here, with these folks that are living in Sheffield. And when Jimmy's house gets the brunt of the explosion, you know, this wave that's coming in, it's like everything ignites on fire. I can't describe, you know, folks, I'm spoiling everything about this film, and it won't matter because there's no way I could describe it like it is in the film. You've got to see the film. But like part of his father's clothes catch on fire. His mother is badly burned. She literally catches on fire, and the father has to get her out. And again, all of this preparation that he has done with these mattresses and stuff, it just all goes up in flames almost. They survive. Probably wish they didn't, because when it's all over, the house is still half burning. You know, and they lived in a house that was like a group of flats, if you've seen London or Great Britain. One of their neighbors had taken off, but they couldn't get out of town because the panic was so great. The roads were too clogged because they were they needed freed up for the military and to try to evacuate. And so everybody was caught out. There was a lot of people out there caught out in the open when this thing went. And they didn't last very long because just the shock blast from even being 17 miles away was probably enough to kill people. They didn't have some kind of protection. But I can't describe it. There's one scene that is very disturbing that involves Jimmy's family's cat dying. I'm sorry, no, it's Ruth's cat dying. And I will tell you this, and Mick Jackson in later interviews in the BBC also said, no animals were harmed. And it looks horrible. It looks like this cat is keeling over, can't breathe or whatever. But what they did was they got the cat some catnip. And any of you who've owned a cat and seen a cat get drunk on catnip know how hilarious that is. Well, they shot that, and then they reversed it, and it made it look like the cat was suffocating. So it looks horrible. And, of course, I'm a big cat lover, so when I saw that, it just tore me to pieces. And the aftermath is what really is the most horrific part of this film. As it's supposed to be. Because remember, Ruth is pregnant. And it was later explained, months later, when people asked the question, how did she survive? Because her grandmother didn't. Her grandmother only lasted about 2 days, and then they had to dispose of the body, basically just take it upstairs. And Ruth couldn't take it anymore. She just cracks, and she takes off. And people say, how did Ruth survive this? Because certainly the levels of radiation in the town were still heavy. I didn't know this until it was explained that because she was pregnant, the baby protected her because the radiation would go after it first. And I will tell you, the baby does survive. And some of the scientists that were critiquing the film said that was the only thing you had to stretch your imagination a little bit on, because more than likely that would not happen. But Ruth, out of all these people we've been introduced so far, is the only one who survives for any length of time. The government people, that just falls apart so quickly, it's unbelievable. As prepared as these people were, the little things that they overlooked. And of course, they're trapped down in this bunker because the buildings totally collapsed on top of them. And they're in contact barely because, you know, communications are just destroyed totally. But there's a little bit of radio communication, and they're trying to get some people there to dig them out. But, you know, they said, don't count on us anytime soon. And, of course, there is a hospital nearby that is absolutely overflowing. But they have no water. They have no painkillers. They have no bandages. Even a lot of their instruments are useless. You see the doctors trying to take glass out of people, out of their heads and stuff, you know, where glass shattered around them, which is a very common thing in this kind of explosion. And they're saying, basically, you or I could be as much help as the doctors are, because there's not much they can do. With all of their training, they don't have what they need to help these people. And, of course, our people in the bunker are dying off one by one. And there's a very poignant scene where a couple of them have been killed already. The air is bad, and all of a sudden everything shakes and they hear this big explosion. And the guy goes, I cannot believe it. Another one? They're still shooting these things off? That's the way it is in a push-button war. Nobody wins. Well, to go ahead and spoil the entire movie here, Ruth does survive. She actually meets up with Jimmy's friend, the one who was in business with him. And let me just say, there's a couple of pretty gruesome scenes as to what they have to do to find food. or to get a meal. And slowly, some things come back together a little bit, but not like you saw the day after. It's pretty much just, it's barbarism. It's just, you know, little tribes of people. The only thing on their mind is to create food. Of course, the ground is not in good shape. It's a nuclear winter. Although I have read recently, and again, I know the theory has changed on that, that some scientists are now thinking that the nuclear winter would not be as severe as they originally thought, but it would be there. I mean, it definitely, that, you know, all of those explosions would have an impact on the climate, but maybe not quite as severe as they originally thought. And we have a very gruesome scene of Ruth delivering her baby by herself in a barn, or what's left of it. And I won't go into graphic detail about it, but you see the birth, and it's a daughter. And then we skip ahead a little bit. We go ahead 10 years, and Ruth dies. There's a lot that happens in between, but, you know, again, Ruth starts out this movie probably in her mid-20s. So imagine now she's in her mid-30s, and she's looks like she's in her 80s, and she passes away, leaving her daughter on her own to fend for herself. And again, this is another aspect of the film that is just horrific. And what we have here, again, is just small tribes of people that are just trying to stay alive. There have been some children that have been born to these people, many of them deformed. So there's still a lot of problems. And her daughter gets raped. Because again, man has become basically not much more than an animal. Probably very close to what he was like in prehistoric times. And the film ends with Ruth's daughter giving birth to a stillborn child. There's no happy endings here because nobody wins in a nuclear war. I got to tell you, folks, watching this film twice this week, the impact it had on me was almost as great as it was the very first few times that I saw it in the 80s and then in the 90s. But I remember when the film Saving Private Ryan came out in 1999, and I can't remember who it was. It was somebody in the Senate. One of the senators said, everybody who has a child and is in a position to send their child to war needs to see that movie. Because from what I remember, it was a senator who had lost a son during a war. And I think a similar attitude has to apply to this film. That anybody who is in a position to control or use nuclear weapons needs to see this movie. But I'll extend it out. I think everybody who is alive needs to see this movie. Because we as a people need to know what we're capable of doing. And for all the rah, 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 sis, boom, bah, and, you know, we're the best country in the world and all this. Once that button is pushed, everybody loses. There are still people out there that believe you can win a nuclear war. And Threads is a film that says, no, you can't. And they ascribe to something that the great Albert Einstein said many years ago. He said he didn't know what weapons would be used fighting World War III, but he knew what weapons would be used fighting World War IV, clubs and rocks. And that's what we see in Threads. This is a very courageous and brilliant film. And I tip my hat to all those involved, especially director Mick Jackson. He's still with us. Mick is still with us. Barry Hines. I am extremely impressed with Karen Meagher and the part that she played, because this is the biggest role she ever had. I mean, like I said, she's done some major work in television since then, but this is still, you know, up until this point, she just basically appeared as a featured extra. And to pull off what she does in this, just watch her performance in this. If you don't pay attention to anything else, it is absolutely remarkable. And what these people, these actors, had to go through, especially the ones whose characters survived the initial blast for a while. I mean, just it's incredible. This had to be a physically brutal shoot. Now, shot in 17 days. 17 days. An incredible film, folks. And like I said, unlike any we have ever done here on Monster Attack. So I thank you for indulging me, because I think this is truly one of the most terrifying horror films ever made. Next week, we got another all-new episode of Monster Attack for you. Comes out every Monday at 5 o'clock. And we thank you for your support this year, folks. We're getting very, very close. We're only about a month and a half away from our 7th anniversary. We're going to have a big blowout show for that one. So looking forward to you then. Have a great week, folks, and we'll see you next Monday.
What are people saying about the Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast?
Yes, what are they saying?
It's a refreshing blend of nostalgia and academia.
I like the animation programming strategy.
I tune in for the amazing celebrity interviews.
An insider's glimpse behind the scenes of your most beloved childhood memories.
What's your website? TheBestSaturdaysOfOurLives.com?
And the amazing ESO Network.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.